Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Now, there's a funny story about the topic, or rather the title of my talk today, because once we set this, when we set this up, I agreed, this was months ago, to come today, and I said I'll send the title closer to date. And when I did, it was like, oh no, but the poster's already done, which was Catholic, political philosophy and Catholicism, which is not really the title for a talk, but more like a research area. So what you have done now is inadvertently sign up for an 8-day long study course that I will host here, same time every day from now on. No, I'm just kidding. So what I will speak about is what you already have on your handout, which is engaging with politics as a Catholic. So I think that will hopefully satisfy anyone who came to that very general talk, but also includes most of the things that I want to say. Good. In the back, can you all hear me, or should I use the microphone? You all good? Okay, good, great. So, yes, do feel free to ask questions afterwards. Trigger alert, I will bring some concrete political examples from my experience. So I am not English, obviously. I'm German, and I follow the politics there more than I do here. I also lived in Italy for 15 years, so I follow their politics and the Vatican politics. So some of the examples may not really be pertinent. Some of them may be too pertinent. So I'm not trying to step on anybody's toes, but just try to make it tangible what I'm about to say. Coming, I guess, out of the, taking the rope out of the ivory tower of academics. All right. So is the young generation political or engaged in politics? When asking this question, one must admit a certain sense of bewilderment. On the one hand, the young generation, and this is clearly a term that only a dad would use, is indeed highly political. Opinions about political matters saturate, or maybe even infest, social media and the public forum. These opinions are as superficial as they are widespread, and with media coverage inflating social issues beyond all proportions at times, young people are basically pummeled into having numerous opinions. So whoever doesn't pick a side in any kind of debate is automatically excluded from a conversation, and worse still, whoever is not on my side is automatically placed as the enemy, oftentimes. What then does a philosopher, a Catholic philosopher no less, and even worse, a German, have to say about politics when the field is already so saturated with information, facts, fake or otherwise, and opinions? And so this is what I'm trying to do today. I want to show how we must engage with politics, what we have to contribute to politics, and what we can learn from political discourse, and maybe what politics can learn from, well, us. So I'm going to do this not from a purely theological point of view, but indeed from a philosophical point of view. While I'm engaged in many theological questions, I am primarily a philosopher by trade, and while as a Catholic, you cannot necessarily distinguish those two, I think that's actually rather a strength than a weakness. So, but that's that's where I'm coming from. So, let's talk about the extremes and how to avoid them. Quote, "I know your works. You're neither cold nor hot. Would that you were cold or hot. So, because you're lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew you out of my mouth." Revelation 3:15. Ever since Adam and Eve were expelled from the Garden of Eden, a deep yearning has been present in the human soul, the desire to return to that very Eden, to paradise, and to reestablish paradise, and ideally paradise on earth. The echo of Eden still rings in our hearts, if you will. The core of this desire is right and just, for it is ultimately the longing to return to the Creator, to be in communion with Him, to be reunited with God in a loving affiliation. Yet in our fallen state, this desire seeks fulfillment in a distorted way. It is misguided because it confuses earthly goals with heavenly beatitude. Thus, the desire to return to the garden does not necessarily lead to deeper faith or to more virtuous life, as you may expect, or as it may should, in order to merit beatitude. Instead, what happens is it is transformed into the misguided project of establishing a heaven on earth, indeed a utopia. Now, there are many examples of this, and we can get into more contemporary examples during the Q&A, but I find it very interesting that this drive to establish utopia actually has a deep root in the Middle Ages. And I'm thinking specifically of Joachim of Fiore, who lived in the 12th century, the early 12th century. What we find in Joachim is what looks like a proper theology of history, but what really turns out to be some kind of misguided form of aforementioned yearning. So Fiore, an abbot of a reformed Cistercian monastery, interpreted the history of the world based on the book of Revelation as well as on visions that he had claimed to have in three stages. So history unfolds over these stages. It is first the age of the Father, then the age of the Son, and then the age of the Holy Spirit. This last stage, he believed, was about to begin in his own lifetime, as many enthusiasts do, as many millenarists do. It's like it's about to happen any day now, tomorrow, the day after tomorrow. What are these three ages? Well, the age of the Father corresponds to the Old Testament and is an age of obedience to the commandments of God the Father. The age of the Son, inaugurated by the New Testament, was an age in which man becomes, in an almost apotheotic, so a divinization of man, sense, a Son of God exemplified in Christ himself, and this idea of the Church being the Corpus Christi, the body of Christ. That was the second age. And the third age, the final age, which was about to begin for Joachim any day now, was the age of the Holy Spirit and was imminent because it would be an age of contemplative utopia and universal love, marked by the gospel, but also transcending it in a sort of eternal gospel kind of way. So in this new age, the new age of the eternal gospel, the Church would be replaced by the order of the just who would rule over it without any sinful institutions. Fiore's vision of history marked the beginning of a genuine shift in mentality in the West, one that would eventually contribute to the Renaissance and leave traces all the way to our own time. This shift is characterized by the desire of or desire for a golden age, the seeking of a golden age, not in some irretrievable past, as it was as it had been done hitherto, but in the future. So the golden age is not something received or longed for as a memory or a lost harmony, but rather something to be made, a place that was about to come, a place, in fact, that we are called to construct, and thus a project that makes us the authors of that very paradise. So the relocation of fulfillment into a to-be-constructed future inevitably fuses religion and politics, for it shifts the impulse to return to a primordial golden age, in the way that, for instance, Mircea Eliade points it, into a forward-driven project whose horizon is ontologically open and accessible only through a quasi-religious imagination and expectation. It is no coincidence, then, that one of the decisive influences of Fiore was on Christopher Columbus in seeking the New World. In fact, Columbus cites Fiore more than once in his letters and in his own prophetic writings. So this is what I would see as kind of like the blueprint of utopian thought, and in fact one political extreme that we ought to avoid. Now, this has a very essential significance for any political thought, for anyone that engages in politics, that listens to politicians, and that wants to say something about what human society should strive for and indeed strives for. So utopia, in the rudimentary form just described, becomes what Thomas Molnar calls a constant pattern of thought. So it permeates political life in at least three, potentially more, areas. The political imagination of the citizen, the rhetoric of politicians, and the philosophically grounded aspirations of any political philosophy. Why in political imagination? So the political imagination, and I have of ordinary citizens, is this idea of the end of history, right, that we heard from Francis Fukuyama. So normal participants in the social life encounter utopian thought as this hope for a final conflict-free world. So it's a world without war, without poverty, without inequality, and indeed is a world that we ought to really strive for. In Fukuyama, it takes the form that liberal democracy represented the culmination of human political development, and it encouraged many people to imagine that ideological conflict or conflict in general had finally ceased. Transhumanists like Yuval Harari, for instance, say that literally. Since war is a problem of the past, now we can look towards the future and towards transhumanism. That would be one example. Another example is in political rhetoric. Politicians frequently exploit utopian impulses in the rhetoric. So in the 20th century obviously offers many examples, from Lenin's vision of the new man to the in a classless society to Barack Obama's slogan, "Yes, we can," which invoked the promise of a moral and social transformation through political will and through political will alone. So in rhetoric, it actually appears quite a bit. And third, what's the philosophical underpinning that I was speaking about? Well, at a theoretical level, utopianism resurfaces in systems that claim to engineer human perfections through scientific education or technology. Transhumanist project, I mentioned Harari already, for instance, envision the overcoming of all human limits, mortality, suffering, and in fact, all human imperfection through biotechnology or artificial intelligence and some kind of hacking. Okay, so this, I would say, is the first extreme to avoid. Now, what's the other side? Any extreme has a countryside, right? So what's the other side? Is it dystopia? Is dystopia to avoid? No. Dystopia is, in fact, somewhat a modern creation. And there was usually no difference between utopian and dystopian thought. It was understood to be the same because the utopian future, as utopian, is actually already hellish. We do not need a counter to this. The dystopia takes the utopian thesis far too seriously, as if utopia was indeed achievable, and then proposes that, well, there's a negative version, and that's the antithesis, and that's dystopia. But the opposite of utopianism is not dystopia, but is political lethargy, political cynicism, the loss of political will, or even the destruction of meaning in politics, a disillusioned relativism, a post-political mentality, and ultimately the reduction of political life into an empty rhetorical shell. So all politics is seen as a mere game of power. So why participate in it? Cannot really blame anyone who doesn't want to participate in that mere game of power. Question is it really a mere game of power? So this stance, this political lethargy or apathy, correctly recognizes the Machiavellian aspects of modern politics, but it reduces all truth and the transcendental elements in political life, even those that are indeed good, true, and beautiful, and reduce it to a political perennial rhetoric of power. So, what can we say to those that have been disillusioned with politics? And I don't encounter this seldomly among Catholics. Okay, there are many different versions of how to participate in politics as a Catholic, and not many of them are quite cynical in their own way. Now, before I tell you to participate in politics, I need to say some words about what politics is. Now, I'm not going to give you a lecture on politics, but some, I guess, groundwork I should mention. So in order to truly engage in politics, we need to clarify what that means. And so politics in, and there's lots more to say, but I leave it at that. Politics, and more precisely the politeia in the classical sense, is the ordering of human life in community towards a common good, grounded in reason and directed ultimately towards the perfection of the human person in virtue and justice. There you go. One sentence definition. I just saved you the money that you can, you would have to pay for, you know, degree in political science. It's not just the organization of the ruler and the ruled, which is what modern political theory oftentimes suggests. So for Plato, politics is the art of caring for the soul of the city, the polis, seeking harmony in all things, between the rational, the spirited, the appetitive elements of both the individual and the whole community. And there was certainly a certain kind of biographical element from Plato, right? Who wanted to become a politician, got disillusioned with the corrupt nature of many politicians and of politics in general, and became a philosopher instead, saying, well, as long as I form those that will go into politics well, then politics will come out well. For Aristotle, politics in the architectonic sense aims at the good life, eudaimonia, the full flourishing of human beings as rational and social creatures who achieve virtue within the polis. Since we are social animals, we are social by nature, our complete fulfillment can only be reached in society. For Aquinas, who picks up these two strands really, politics participates in the divine order, making a very long story short. So the natural means by which man pursues the temporal goods, according to right reason, participate ultimately in the nature and the eternal law of God. So as Catholics, we may slightly, with slight adaptions, take the classical account by saying politics is the rational and communal pursuit of the common good, ordering human life towards virtue and, through virtue, towards its ultimate fulfillment in God. Now, with this definition, a maybe to some familiar tension emerges. Politics aims at the good life, yet the highest good of man lies beyond politics. And this is a problem. This tension is already, in a nutshell, visible in Aristotle's own distinction between the active life of the citizen and the contemplative life oriented towards the divine. And this problem returns throughout all the Aristotelian kind of authors in the question of, well, so is the best politician or the best engagement in politics to retreat from politics? Maybe then resonating this cynical stance that I spoke about among many Catholics. So how can we, what can we say towards this tension? How can we tackle this tension that politics aims at the good of man, but the full good of man goes beyond politics? Well, in the words of Father Scholl, quote, the most famous book in all political theory proposed that the virtue of man as man is justice, but the very same book, Plato's Republic, if you have not guessed it, is also recognized that true justice will never be found among men and institutions. And here the problem begins, in fact, many problems. On the one hand, politics necessarily deals with the good, okay, beginning with what you could call, maybe in some political theory, basic goods, and eventually encompasses all goods that enable a good life for every human being, ideally. Yet the good in itself encompasses the whole man and would include his spiritual nature, so the desire for a heavenly beatitude. So now, a final fulfillment cannot be achieved by politics if politics does not take that final fulfillment into consideration in some way. So politics deals with the good it cannot deliver. What belongs to Caesar is not what belongs to God, and vice versa. Now, Aristotle taught that politics concerns itself with enabling an educated man not to merely live, but to live well. And this seemingly simple claim can open an entire anthropological horizon. So, to live well means to live in accordance with virtue, to live a life shaped by reason, by friendship, by justice, and the ordered pursuit of the good, all realities deeply focused on man's religious nature and, in fact, interwoven with it. So in this sense, then, Aristotle does affirm both sides of the coin while not having an understanding of eternal beatitude that, let's say, Aquinas or Catholic social teaching would have. On one side, then, all human aspirations, also the political ones, remain bounded by the limits of human nature, and indeed, man cannot make anything, cannot be made into anything other than man. He is recognized as what he is, and neither kind of talked down to as if he were a beast, nor engineered into a god or some kind of flawless citizen. Politics cannot erase the passions, it cannot abolish death, it cannot abolish weakness, and to borrow from Catholic lingo, it cannot abolish sin or the need for grace. So these limits are in fact the contours of what it means to be human. Thus, for Aristotle, politics neither promises a false perfection nor despair of the human condition. It recognizes, maybe best, man's finite nature and tries to furnish a space where living well in this finite form becomes possible. So, politics must respect both the dignity and the limit of human nature. It must aim high, but always within the horizon of what is actually realizable. Okay. Now, this does not change, or should not change, even when we look at politics from a modern perspective, or within the modern sphere, let's say. Wherever you want to locate that, in Machiavelli, or in Hobbes, or in any subsequent thinker. What I think actually marks the transition from modern political thinking departing from the traditional way of thinking about politics is actually not so much the rethinking of politics as it is the rethinking of man, what it means to be human. In the classic Christian tradition, man is understood as an integrated unity of body and soul ordered towards a transcendent good. And the early moderns deliberately recast this very same man as an isolated, self-preserving individual whose primary motivation is security, fear, or utility. And that's then very easy. Once you have human nature based that way, then the goals of politics kind of fall into your lap as the natural outcome. Well, if he wants security, and if that's achieved by fear or by utility, then that's exactly what politics has to do. So by slowly robbing man of his integrated body-soul nature, that Jamie told me you had a previous DI talk on, so I'm making a footnote here to my dear colleague Danielle DeHaan, by slowly robbing man of his integrated body-soul nature and by hollowing out the spiritual core of the human being, this yearning, okay, so denying the very reality of this yearning for God, modern political theory steadily moves away from any acknowledgement of his spiritual thirst. And the result of that is not that the thirst is gone. The result of that is the triumph of a new illusion that man's desire for transcendence is not merely irrelevant to politics, but in fact doesn't even exist. So religious and spiritual life were pushed to the private and sentimental sphere, stripped of all public significance. So I think it is fair to say that we find ourselves in the middle of a rather uncomfortable tension. On the one hand, the human being is always involved in politics because of his social nature, and this nature bears a desire, in fact, a teleology, that the true fulfillment of humanity lies, of every individual human being and of human nature, lies in a societal good, the common good. On the other hand, we need to insist that politics does not deal with only the most mundane and quotidian needs, but also with the good as such, the good in common. In fact, this good that then participates in the divine and includes a desire of heavenly beatitude. So, a very precarious situation indeed. Now, if you're interested more in the subject, then I highly recommend you getting a political science degree. That is not what I'm to do here, or what I'm about to do here, but I was thinking of, well, what can be some specifically philosophical and Catholic elements that can help you participate and engage with politics? So I've collected five, there are probably more, but those five I just want to briefly illustrate. The first is think critically in a Catholic way. The Catholic intellectual tradition insists that genuine critique presupposes truth. Without an anchor in what is real, critique collapses into self-dissolving skepticism. A mind that is open, or that has opened itself to questioning, does so in order to find an answer. And this may be recalled St. Paul, who says, test everything, hold fast to what is good. So you have to do both. You have to test it, but you also have to hold fast to it. You cannot just do the good because it has always been done, and you can also not just test everything. So the act of testing is ordered towards a recognition, in fact, not a destruction, but a construction or a reception. So within that horizon then, Catholic understanding or understanding in general of the Catholic thinker over time takes what has been received, but always testing if it remains or if it still stays true. And that's kind of the beauty of having revelation, having truth, but also being encouraged by St. Paul to test, to truly critically think. So what would be a specific application of that? And there are many. Maybe what's very pertinent is evaluating a Christian and a secular nationalism. So what would this approach of testing help us, teach us, in evaluating, well, nationalism, secular nationalism or Christian nationalism in general? A Catholic critique or a Catholic critical mind refuses both the naive embrace and the knee-jerk reaction to the phenomenon like Christian nationalism. On the one hand, Catholic teaching always recognizes the importance of the nation and having a national identity, and indeed how that national identity is tied to cultural continuity, to historical memory, to the preservation of Christian moral principles in public life and many other things. On the other hand, the Church also detects when political actors instrumentalize Christian symbols as identity markers that are devoid of conversion or moral content or, in fact, real discipleship. And this has happened throughout all of history. We don't have to say this about only contemporaries, right? A certain absolute enlightened monarchy, as we've seen in France, by a Catholic king, is maybe not as Catholic as it claimed to be. There's much to say about that, though. Okay, so the Catholic critique rejects a reductive secular accusation that any religiously shaped patriotism and nationalism is inherently dangerous, and it rejects the political temptation to baptize ideological projects simply by associating them with Christian symbolism or sophistry. And this, I mean, even I myself have had experience with this, because as a Catholic, I'm home everywhere, because I'm Catholic, but I'm also kind of home nowhere. Right? And I've lived, I mean, much of my time outside of Germany, for instance. Yet Germany remains very dear to me. So, anyways. Second point. This seems very technical, maybe actually the easiest one. The et versus the out. So the and, the also and, rather the either or. Aristotle calls reason the power of discernment, distinguishing causes and ends to recognize the good. Very much builds on what we just said. Modern post-Hegelian dialectic seems to play sides against each other, so opposing sides without making a common ground possible. Catholic thought instead resists the modern either-or logic and embraces the both-and, which is ultimately rooted in the analogy of being. Analogy reveals that there is an ordered plurality within unity. There is a diversity, but the diversity springs out of unity, not the other way around. So God and creation, as an example, and that doesn't seem to be very political yet, but I'll get there. God and creation are neither identical nor wholly separate, but related through proportion, which is the literal meaning of analogy. So this is an integrative understanding of opposing poles. So what would be an application? Well, one application that I could think of is, and I've lived in the US, my wife is from the States, this whole debate between Republicans and Democrats. Right? Now, one can argue lots about if the United States were originally designed to have a two-party system, but it is now what it is, so that's what we kind of have to deal with. And the question is, well, for an American Catholic, then who do they vote for? And in the States, it's particularly pertinent how you really have to side with one or the other. The one always says that the other is the devil, sometimes very literally. Okay, so what to do? And it's like, well, the Catholic can stand beyond that dialectic and can say, well, whenever each party is right in what they say about a certain issue, then that's the good way to go. Now, does it tell you who to vote for? No. But it gives you a stance that stays aloof in a certain way, stands above a certain kind of bipolar thinking. You have other applications. The one that you have on your handout is immigration and national identity, right? Again, this is a huge topic in Germany. I'm sure here it is as well. This idea of the... So the Catholic can affirm both the inviolable dignity of the migrant and the legitimate need of a political community to preserve a cultural cohesion, a rule of law, and in fact, social stability. In Germany, we had this whole debate, this was in the 90s, a long time ago now, about cultural integration. Yeah, you know, we just integrate all of the migrants. It's like, that integration has thoroughly failed. Like, today, German primary schools cannot even teach German anymore in some places because nobody speaks it. Okay, how to deal with that? Well, we cannot really turn the migrants into some form of an alien or subhuman, not at all. Quite the opposite. The Catholic can see, well, okay, yes, we need to uphold the dignity. Every human being is completely equal in the face of God and among each other, but at the same time, living in a country requires you to take on certain responsibilities when it comes to knowledge, integration, and so forth. The third point, this may be the most difficult from a theoretical point of view, the principle of non-contradiction versus the principle of identity. Catholic openness to the truth is the antidote to common modern disorder of political relativism. This principle of identity, so that being cannot be and not be at the same time in the same way, grounds a certain realism, but a realism that is dynamic and that goes against the principle of identity as it was developed in more modern thought, and specifically in the rationalists, which states that A equals A. So truth can be spoken in many different ways and is not, one does not exclude the other. A good illustration of that, and this is a good image, is the Garden of Eden and God's command in regards to the tree of knowledge. We generally, and this may be informed by artists throughout the centuries, imagine the Garden of Eden as this beautiful place with one tree in the center, which is the tree of knowledge, and which is usually also the biggest tree. And so God's like, okay, you can live here, but don't eat off that tree. And you're basically in this little confined playground that has a tree in the middle, and you're like, really? Like, what are we supposed to do here other than, okay, and then eat off that tree? We have to think about the Garden of Eden very differently. The Garden of Eden had probably billions of trees. They're everywhere, to the horizon, on all sides. And that's where man was created. And then there was one tree somewhere in the corner, and God's like, do not eat of that tree. I think that makes it a little bit more, at least the image is a little bit clear in what I'm trying to say here. So the principle of non-contradiction does not say no. God said primarily no, but he said primarily yes to everything, but not to the one thing. Okay? You can do 99 things, but the one thing you cannot do. Okay, this is opposed in a strong tension to this principle of identity, which is, well, A equals A. So if God denies something, then that's what we have to take most seriously. No, then denial comes after an affirmation. And so my application here is the kind of women's rights issue and that whole discourse. Modern political rhetoric frequently collapses into these kind of contradictions, and in fact, a contradiction that only a Catholic, I think, can name clearly. Affirming the dignity and rights of women while simultaneously defending an act that terminates the life of the most vulnerable human being, and condemn that, which is the unborn child, which oftentimes is a woman, right? So the non-contradiction principle forces clarity. One cannot defend human rights while excluding an entire class of human beings from those rights. That defeats the whole purpose of human rights. So the modern identity principle reduces human dignity to self-ownership, right? My body, my choice, it's me. The Catholic realist would respond, well, human dignity is first of all given, and then it's relational. So yeah, it's you, but it's you because you have received the gift of life. We all have. We all only stand here because God at a certain point decided to create. So it's not the product of willpower. And thus, the unborn child, from this point of view, possesses the same dignity that any born person would have. And I think that this analysis gives Catholics a particularly clear vision in this matter. Fourth, philosophical thought and religious hermeneutics. Human thought unfolds within time, yet reaches beyond it. So, and this is very clear to me in the Church's Magisterium, which embodies attention while preserving unchanging truth. So the Church's teaching remains the same, it's Christ's teaching, but has to be always applied in a new way. So, for instance, the Second Vatican Council's document Dei Verbum calls Scripture and tradition one sacred deposit entrusted to the Church. So it is revelation, and in that it has to be hermeneutically approached. So one can never go against the other. Right? When there is a seeming contradiction, then theologians, hopefully good theologians, will show you that there is actually no contradiction or how to deal with a seeming contradiction. So a striking example of that is this question of human dignity and slavery. The truth that every human being is created in the image of God, what we've already mentioned, is not a discovery of the 16th century, obviously. It roots in the creation account of Genesis itself, right? Let us make them in our image. Its full moral and social implications, however, need to be reworked in every generation, and indeed whenever human nature and the dignity of a human person is assailed. So in the debates that were sparked by the discovery of the New World, Bartolomé de las Casas insisted against prevailing assumptions and legal structures, okay, against the law, and even the inertia of some Christian kings, that indigenous people of the Americas possessed the same God-given dignity as any European. But by doing that, he did not invent a new principle, he just simply applied an old and perennial principle to a new situation, and a new situation that called for urgency. And I think this is a great way of looking at any kind of philosophical analysis or any kind of philosophical answering of any problem. And this also counts for political application. So what's the application? I would say this could be maybe a good guide in the talk on artificial intelligence, or so-called artificial intelligence, and technological governance. So AI and how much it should be involved in governance or local or regional or global is a good example of tech elites speaking about AI in a vocabulary that is really of rupture, of novelty, and it kind of shows an epistemic revolution, right? This is a completely new thing and poses completely new problems. The great thing about completely new problems is that whoever comes up with a completely new solution then will be the solution that is best fit. But I think a Catholic hermeneutic of continuity can insist that, yes, technologies are developing, technologies must be understood as, and can be understood as something that can improve, and will in fact improve, as we have already seen, but they cannot touch on certain anthropological perennial truths. So for instance, that man is rational, is embodied, is moral, is a being of truth and communion, and in fact has intelligence, and really nothing else has, save angels. So AI should never be allowed to redefine personhood in that way. And the Catholic hopefully, can then say, well, yes, we integrate the good bits of this development, but we also have to be shying away from the possible negative consequences. So the stance neither rejects innovation nor does it worship innovation. It tries to do a proper middle ground and, in fact, base himself on, well, what human nature is traditionally understood to be. Okay, last point. Truth as something given, not as something made. So the datum, not the factum. Truth for the Catholic is received. It is not made. Right? It is a datum. It is a gift that in fact precedes thought, not a factum produced by it. So Gilson has pointed this very well by saying that Catholics don't believe in the cogito ergo sum, but rather res sunt ergo cogito. So things are, therefore I think. So being grounds thought, not vice versa. And this is a certain metaphysical humility which culminates in a sacramental vision of reality where creation signifies ultimately divine presence. Right? God's self-revelation in Exodus 3:14, the I am who am, and Christ's words, for instance, this is my body, manifest being as a gift and a sign, maybe one that we don't necessarily intuitively understand, but one that remains true nonetheless. So in this light, then, faith safeguards reason from self-enclosure, directing it towards its real end, towards its real telos. And here again, and you see that I'm kind of picking examples from kind of the same field of problems. A political example of this would be debates about human dignity and, well, the beginning of life. Right? If truth is something that is primarily something made, so a factum, then the dignity of the unborn becomes a matter of convention, of majority vote, of something that, well, you can make, of a legal definition. So human worth is assigned, is negotiated, and potentially is withheld according to the social consensus or ideological preference. The person becomes a product of political will. Now, if the truth is a given, is a datum, then the dignity of the human person is a given reality, which is anterior to law and independent of political power. So, for instance, the unborn child is, therefore he is worthy, and that's it. The dignity is not granted by the state, it's not based on a right, but the state recognizes that which already is. And so, this is why the Church opposes laws that redefine personhood based on utility or development or desire, because they're all ultimately based on the assumption that we can make reality rather than receive reality. All right. Now, what is my conclusion then? My conclusion here is that Catholics ought to engage in politics, understood in a specific but also in the most broad sense. And this, in fact, is the most integral sense of the term. As C.S. Lewis observed, the family is the first society that creates its own citizens, and all members of that society, of the family of man, of the citizens, are called to inhabit and sanctify the social order according to their vocation. Laypersons, spouses, priests, bishops, whatever. But you have to have a specific, and you do have a specific role to play in politics. And this is, I think, the greatest strength, actually. This is what politics can learn from us, which is the faith and supernatural truth is above politics. It does not absolutize politics, but it also refuses to be captured by the political factions. Right? When politics becomes polarized into tribes, the Catholic stance, the Catholic vision, which is grounded in the transcendent understanding of reality and of truth, goodness, beauty, stands above these competing banners without retreating from public life. In fact, oftentimes we are the only ones that do that. So it neither baptizes the slogans of the left nor canonizes the instincts of the right, but it judges all political claims based by a higher measure: truth, justice, the common good, the dignity of the human person, and the natural and supernatural goals of that very same self, same person. So I would propose that if Catholics live these outline principles, they will not really be another voice in the public square. There will also be another voice, but there will be a decisive one. So with that, I'd say go in peace and sanctify the public square. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.